Okay, I guess I would start with, we're thinking about Olam Haba, and this is a really interesting topic for us to deal with, because a lot of our topics have, based on the things people request, tend to be, for lack of a better term, newer ideas. So either issues associated with modernity, with technological innovation, with all sorts of contemporary thinking. But when we talk about Olam Haba, I don't think we have that, advantage and disadvantage, right? It's a very old idea, so on the one hand, there's going to be an extensive literature about the subject, kind of probing different details associated with Olam Haba. But on the other hand, we all come in, I think, with pretty strong, I was going to say strongly held notions, or at least preconceptions. Like, we think we know what we're talking about when we talk about Olam Haba. And so our goals are going to include trying to figure out what those notions are, figure out how accurate or inaccurate they are, where we can clarify some details. Overall, the structure is going to be tackling two major questions and maybe a minor question to go with it. Right? So major question number one is, what is, you say the word Olam Haba all the time, what is it literally? Like, what is it going to be? When will it happen? What does it look like? And then a question of, okay, so granted that I understand what Olam Haba is, why does it matter? What does it mean that there is the Olam Haba that will have this or that implication for me? And we'll see if there are other questions that we'll kind of probe at along the way. So I'll start by asking you, right? What's Olam Haba?
World after death.
Okay, so already you said one thing, which is the world Olam Haba, but you didn't translate Haba means the world that is coming. You mean the world after death, mm-hmm. right? So Olam Haba, you're saying, is not like Mashiach's going to come and then the world will be different because we won't have died. Okay, can you tell me more? Like, what else is, what is it going to look like? Who's going to be there? When do we go there? Let's fill in the picture a little bit.
Well, I think the Garden of Eden might be there.
Okay, so there's a thing called Gan Eden. That's a different subject that we'll probably touch on very parenthetically, but isn't necessarily essential. But you're thinking of, if I'm understanding you correctly, like a space. There's a place where people will be that's called Gan Eden that has certain features, and that's what Olam Haba is. Mm-hmm. Okay, that might be one angle on Olam Haba. Though I think you might be combining different aspects of different approaches to Olam Haba, so we'll flesh those out in just a minute. What other like preconceptions do we have about Olam Haba? What's Olam Haba going to look like?
Like our version of heaven, in a way.
Okay, so it's sort of like a heavenly thing, mm-hmm. right? It's, now, I don't know if we mean like, you know, the Christian heaven with the angels and the cloud floor, like that kind of heaven, or just a notion of heaven, that you die and you go to this place called Olam Haba. Okay, right, that's like one, you know, picture you might have of Olam Haba. This might not be the only picture of Olam Haba. Both answers we've heard so far assume that Olam Haba is a place that you go when you die. Does everyone go to Olam Haba? I'm seeing some, you know, who get into Olam Haba, what's the alternative to Olam Haba? So we could talk about Gehenin, that's another, you know, a side issue.
Well, a lot of people still go to Gehenin
and then. Depending on what Gehenin is, so is Gehenin like a, what you would call like a purgatory, where you go to Gehenin and then you kind of like bake out all the sin, and then eventually everyone makes it to Olam Haba at the end. So this picture that I think everyone's talking about so far is Olam Haba as afterlife. You live in this world, it's a great world, and then you die, and then through whatever process, which may be a simple process or a complicated process, you end up in this place called Olam Haba.
It's not so much an afterlife, because it's really a home. You're not, like, really living. You're not
going to
live there.
Okay, right. So it's called an afterlife, presumes there's a thing called life, and you're saying it's not even life. You're just a soul. You're not a body at all. So what does it mean to be alive? I could push back and say, well, maybe your soul is like the most living thing you have. You know, this is like a thing of meat. That's not so important. It's going to, you know, degrade over time, but my soul doesn't do that. So maybe like it's the best life, the purest life. So that's an interesting picture. I think this is interesting to me. I had no preconception about what people would think of when they think of Olam Haba. But it seems like there's a more or less a commonality around this idea of like a heavenly space. And this is one idea, and it's popularized by the Rambam, but it's one idea of Olam Haba. There's a whole other idea that we might use that will have, I think, pretty big implications for how we think about what Olam Haba is, what ultimate reward is going to look like, things like that. So there's a debate in the classical commentaries. Now, I'll preface this by saying, if I wanted to ask you, okay, what do you know about Olam Haba? You'll tell me what you think. If I then said, well, how do you know what you know about Olam Haba? I would hope no one says from personal experience. That would raise troubling questions. Interesting ones, but problematic ones. But most of what we know is either going to be from tradition. There'll be sources that tell us things about Olam Haba that we have to rely on. Or if we don't have tradition to rely on, we may have philosophy. We may be able to derive certain things from, you know, it's logically impossible that Olam Haba should be this or that, and so it should be something else. In the interest both of time and of clarity, I decided to not flesh out most of those philosophical issues because they rely on certain like medieval conceptions of matter and permanence and rationality and the forces of nature that are hard to wrap our heads around. So I just want to present the two major schools and we'll see what we can derive about those different schools of thought. They're summarized in this great, great work called the Sefer HaIkarim. The Sefer HaIkarim was written in the, I'll say the 15th century, 14th or 15th century by Yosef Albo. And it's not accurate to call it a summary of medieval Jewish philosophy because he's not, you know, he's not an encyclopedia. Like he's presenting his perspectives on the right, on issues, and he's not being, you know, totally neutral and unbiased. But it's a great introductory work. If you want to know what Rishonim say about what Olam Haba is, what Gehenna is, how Scharva Onesh works, how prophecy works, all those kinds of issues, well, he'll summarize, you know, major views, and then he'll pick a side that he likes the best. So he summarizes in the fourth section of the book, Paraklamid, two different approaches to what Olam Haba is. He starts with the, we call it like the heavenly approach, which is mostly summarized by Rambam, and we'll see a few sources from the Rambam a little bit later, but the way he summarizes it is as follows. And for our purposes, we'll read from the English, which will be a little bit clearer, I think, than trying to break it down in the Hebrew. Concerning the spiritual reward, which comes to a man after death, man is a neutral term here, as far as I know. The later Jewish thinkers are divided into two schools. The one, the first one, holds that while it is true that the perfectly righteous receive in this world reward for their deeds, as did the patriarchs, right? So don't think that all of the reward that we get for our good deeds happens in a later next world. Some people get reward in this world. Abraham, Isaac, and Yaakov became rich. They became powerful. They had families, they had children, they had land, all of that in reward for their righteousness. Nevertheless, the main reward is spiritual, bestowed upon the soul alone in the world to come, i.e. the world which comes to a person after death, as soon as the soul is separated from the body. So you go to some world, you die, and then you go to some world of just souls. There are no bodies there. And in that world, a world in which there is no eating or drinking or any of the physical pleasures. And as our rabbis say, they quote a source that's going to be an important source for us a little bit later. In the next world, there is neither eating nor drinking, nor hatred, nor envy, nor strife. But the righteous sit with their crowns on their heads and enjoy the splendor of the Shekhinah. The meaning is, the crown, it's not a literal crown. When it means you sit with your crown, the crown of a good name resulting from your good deeds stands above their heads and confers upon them the privilege of enjoying the splendor of the Shekhinah. So it's a spiritual world, and the pleasure you get in the spiritual world is not angels playing harps. It's the pleasure of being in the presence of God. And it's one of those things that's very, if I knew what it would be, I would try to describe it to you, and it would be hard to describe to you, and I also don't know what it looks like. So let's say there's this very pleasurable state that a soul can have in being connected to and exposed to God. The next paragraph is not as, yeah, no, that's included as well, right? So that, I think, is the model that we default to. We think about Olam Haba, it's where you go when you die. Whether you go through a purgatory or not, whether you go there immediately or not, you go there when you die. That's one version of Olam Haba. Now, that's not the only thing that happens as we approach, you know, the end of things. The men of this opinion also hold that while the main reward is purely spiritual, there is also another corporeal reward in this world at the time of the Messiah. This is the same as the time of the resurrection, Tchiyat HaMetim, when the perfectly righteous will come to life. Let's pause there for a second. So one problem that philosophers have to deal with when dealing with concepts like Olam Haba is how they network with all sorts of other concepts. Olam Haba, Gan Eden, Tchiyat Hamitim, Yemot HaMashiach. Each of these terms is a little bit fraught, and so the philosophers try to figure out how they fit together. Are they the same? Are they different? So the view of Rambam that Sefer HaYikarim is summarizing and he prefers is to say Olam Haba is a personal experience. You die, your soul goes into this realm of souls. All the stuff that all the other things on that list are things that happen in this world. So Mashiach is going to come in this world, and the world will be a little bit different because Mashiach has come and will be redeemed, and will no longer be in exile or subjugated to other people. And Tchiyat HaMetim will happen, which means people will be resurrected from the dead. And Gan Eden is a place, Gan Eden is a more complicated issue, so we'll leave that to the side. Okay, if I told you that there's an ultimate reward in the world of souls, so you've been there, let's say you died in the year 1500, and let's say Mashiach comes in the year 2500. I have no idea when Mashiach is going to come. So for 1,000 years, you've been dwelling in this beautiful world of souls, and all of a sudden, an angel knocks on the door and says, Tchiyat HaMetim time, and they open the door, and everyone comes back to their bodies on earth. Right, so there are problems, like what happens if your spouse got remarried after you died, and who are they married to now, and like there are issues that come up, in like the technical issues, but more fundamentally, like why do you want to come back from the dead? You're in the ultimate world of souls, that's the best, that's what we want. So we get to come back and we get to do more mitzvot, but okay, like, we had a lifetime to do that, I guess we got another one, right? You can't do more mitzvot in heaven, mitzvot don't really apply to souls, they apply to people in, you know, on earth. So the Sefer HaYikarim presents a couple of different angles, why you would want to come back, what the value is of that historical process. Either, in the third line on the bottom of the, in the last English paragraph on the page, either in order to publish God's miracles and truth, right? At the time of Yom HaMashiach, we want to convince the entire world that God exists and that God is true, and so we need some massive miracle to prove that that's the case. Or in order that they may receive some corporeal pleasure corresponding to the pain they suffer during life, right? All the suffering that happens in this world, so I get my ultimate spiritual reward, but I also need to get some physical reward as well. So I had a terrible, awful life, and I come back to get a really great life. And that kind of makes up for it. Or, more, according to the divine wisdom shall decree, you might get even more reward than you deserve. Or in order that they may acquire a higher perfection than before, in case they were not able in their lifetime to attain the degree to which they were entitled. So that, I think, is the answer we just heard, that you go to continue to improve yourself. So your job on earth is to improve yourself and to grow, and you achieve 80% of your potential on earth, and that's great, and you get into Olam Haba. And then you come back to earth to finish perfecting yourself, which means more mitzvah, more learning Torah, all the good things we get to do on earth that transform our character. Then they will die again. Ah, that's weird, right? You think about Tchiyat HaMetim as this like eternal, beautiful process. No, you come back for another, like, doesn't say how long, you come back for another lifetime, another 70 years, and then you die again. But this time you'll have accomplished what you were meant to accomplish. You will have learned, you will have grown more, you would have done more mitzvot, you would have gotten the reward you deserved, etc. And then your real eternal life is still in Olam Haba. Olam Haba is really the main thing. And Tchiyat HaMetim is this like background process. To the point where Rambam, who I mentioned is the view associated with his position, was accused of not believing in Tchiyat HaMetim. And he has a whole letter called the Igeret Tchiyat HaMetim, the letter of the resurrection, where he has to say, no, like, everyone's misunderstanding me, no, Tchiyat HaMetim is totally real, and I really believe in it. It's just, like, not so important. Like, it's not a big deal that Tchiyat HaMetim is going to happen. It's true, and it's an important thing to believe is true, but who cares? Like, it's really just kind of the background, and the main thing that you get is Olam Haba. That's, like, the most important reward. And they'll return to dust, and their souls will have improved. This is the view, last two lines, of Maimonides and the distinguished men who came after him and adopted his opinion. If we examine this view, we find it is correct and inevitably logical and in agreement with the Torah. Right? Our philosophy will prove it to us, and our tradition and our texts will prove it to us. So that's model number one, which I think is the model that we mostly think of. When someone dies, you talk about Olam Haba, and that's the experience. But it's not, I think, the only model, nor is it an obvious way to understand what Olam Haba is, and when you look at traditional sources. And I'm not even sure it's the majority. He says it's Maimonides and the men who came after him, and it seems like the majority of us in this room at least kind of default to that understanding. But the majority of Rishonim, who I've seen who write about this issue, assume a different understanding of what Olam Haba is like. The Dat Hashini, the second opinion. So let's just pay attention to how this picture differs from the Rambam's picture. We'll see a few differences. The second opinion, is that though the perfectly righteous get material reward in this world, yet there are not, since their number is small and the great majority of righteous men do not get corporeal reward in this world, there should be in the next word corporeal as well as spiritual reward. In other words, it's not a world of souls. Then you'd only have spiritual reward. You also need to have some element of physicality and corporeality in order to have physical reward. That's what's fair. This comes, they say, after the resurrection when the soul and the body will exist in conjunction. So it's not a world of souls, it's a world of souls and bodies. Maybe not exactly like our bodies, but some kind of body that exists. Right? I don't know, growing up in school I heard this idea that Adam HaRishon had a body, he wasn't an angel, but his body was like qualitatively different than our bodies. That it wasn't, you know, Adam HaRishon would have been immortal if he hadn't eaten from the Eitz HaDaat. You hear these ideas, that there's such a thing as a physical body that doesn't decompose and that isn't, you know, mortal. And that's what this view is proposing. So it's a physical body without eating and drinking. So it's not going to be food. You're not going to need food because you're going to survive without it. This is, according to them, what the rabbis call the world to come. When they say concerning the righteous that they are prepared for the life of the world to come. They believe that at the same time as the human soul does not die when the body dies, but that there's a stage of existence called Gan Eden, where immediately after death, the souls of the righteous are kept until they rise in resurrection and obtain the life in the world to come after the resurrection. Okay, so we could reorder the concepts, right? For the Rambam, Olam Haba is the main thing. That's what lasts eternally. And there's a break where you come back for resurrection. For this other view, which is the view of Ramban and the Ramah, Ramir Abalafia, and the Ravid, and many other Rishonim, it's basically flipped. There's the spiritual place called Gan Eden. That's where your soul like hangs out between dying and the end of days. And then the world will be fundamentally transformed. And then we'll all come back and we'll live in this world just in a uplifted, almost supernatural kind of way, where we're physical, but we're no longer limited in all the ways that physical beings are limited. We won't need to eat, we won't need to drink. We'll have it great. It'll be a wonderful, different world than the world we currently live in. Okay, he quotes a couple of proof texts. Let's save that for the end. And he summarizes the opinion of Nachmanides, the Ramban, or Rameir Halevi Abulafia, and a number of modern writers who follow them. He's writing in the 14th, you know, the late medieval period, so it's not so modern. But that's another view. Which is interesting in that it's, you know, not exactly the sense of Olam Haba that we're used to. It's a physical world. It's a physical world that is not so different necessarily from ours. We're supernatural, but we're not just spiritual. And it happens not to individuals. It's not that individuals go to Olam Haba. It's that the world becomes Olam Haba. It is the world to come in that it will replace our world. Not the world to come in that it's the world that comes to us or that we go to when we die. So two major camps in terms of understanding, just very basically by definition, what's the world going to look like? What is Olam Haba? Yes, Pat.
Based on what you just said.
Yeah.
So, in the second, by the way, it does say it is obvious there are many objections to this conception.
Yeah, he very clearly is a partisan. He likes the Rambam's view.
In this one, this happened to everybody. Like, in this, what they're explaining here is the Olam of the Gan Eden part happens, and then there's the resurrection part, and that's the whole world goes through that.
So he doesn't describe... That's interesting. Right? Does everyone have to die for this process to happen? Offhand, and without reading his entire, you know, treatment of the position, it seems like no. It seems like the world will be transformed, right? I think sometimes we have, like, kind of incompatible notions about these things. Like, we think Olam Haba is that spiritual world of souls. But I think if you ask a lot of people, like, what the Messianic age will look like, I think we describe it as being very qualitatively different than the world that we currently live in. So I think people have this notion that Yemot HaMashiach are very different, whether you assume that death exists at all in Yemot HaMashiach or not. You have to, you know, ask people what their sort of intuitive notions are. But I think the sense is that, yeah, nature will be transformed. And if Mashiach came right now, we'd be in this room, but our bodies would transform into some kind of heightened physical body that doesn't need food or drink anymore. And then we'd all go to Yerushalayim and offer a Korban Pesach that we don't need to eat. You have to, like, work out some of the details. But...
Why does it have to be some magical process? We know stories of rabbis in the past that they sleep very little, 45 minutes a night maybe, They don't really eat. Why does it have to be some magical...
Because I think if you're going to hit a person, if you're going to hit a point where people are immortal, that seems to be a deviation from what we currently know. Now, we could prove that and see whether that's really true.
But why would the opportunity to do this be taken away?
Okay, so I think that's hitting a slightly different point, which is one of the questions we have to probe.
If you can't make breakfast, then you're taking away how many mitzvahs already?
Oh, okay. I'm understanding your question better now. So just to make sure I understand, you're saying if the physical world transforms, so a lot of the things that we normally associate as part of Torah, things that are valuable, by definition won't be applicable anymore. Right? If we don't need to eat or drink, so we won't make bracha, for example.
So why does it have to be some magical, intangible concept of a transformation? Why can't it just be that we're enlightened in the truth of God and then we won't need it as much?
That's also a possibility, right? So we're not dealing directly with the question of what Mashiach's going to look like. If you asked, for example, the Rambam, he would tell you, well, the Messianic era will be very similar to what we have now. It's just a world where the Jewish people aren't subjugated and where knowledge of God is more pronounced and universal than it currently is. So right now we live in a world where it's not obvious, God's presence isn't obvious, and the truth of God or God as we understand him isn't obvious. But the idea of, for the Rambam at least, is that we'll be enlightened and we'll be autonomous. And those are the major differences. And the Rambam thinks, even in the world of Yom HaMashiach, we'll still die. You'll just go to that second level of Olam Haba, right? But you'll still have a world that's very similar to what we have now. So I think those are like broadly two schools, right? One that assumes that the physical world will really be transformed in some kind of way, and one where it won't. Maybe this will help a little bit more, which is to try to probe one level deeper and say, okay, I know that there are these two views, right? And let's assume for the moment that there's like some plausible philosophical way to explain each of these views. So the question I want to hit at is, what is the like root cause of their debate, right? What ideas do they disagree about that lead to these different conclusions? Right? Because if I just give you the term Olam Haba and I like let you speculate about what Olam Haba would be kind of freely, so what you generate will, I think, be reflective of how you understand certain basic concepts. And so I want to try to touch on different ways of understanding like what the underlying debate is that yields these different conclusions about how to understand Olam Haba. And I think we could try, I think we have time for all of them. So let's see if we could do three different underlying debates or three different issues that would affect what which of these two camps are going to like most. First debate is an interpretive debate, right? We have sources, traditional sources, in Mishnah, in Gemara, in Midrash, that describe Olam Haba. And the language that they use is physical language. They describe a world. They describe a world that changes. They describe the Sefer HaYikara mentioned, tzaddikim sitting with crowns on their heads. So if I'm a soul, I can't sit, and I can't wear a crown. So you have these descriptions. So one debate is, when you see these descriptions in traditional sources, do you have to read them literally, or can you read them metaphorically or allegorically? So according to the opinion that sees the world of Olam Haba as a basically physical world, an upgraded physical world, that will last forever, in which people will live in physical, eternal bodies. You'll read these sources mostly literally. When it says they'll sit with crowns on their head, they will literally sit with literal crowns on their literal heads, because they'll still have heads. But the Rambam would tell you, no, when you see sources like this, you're supposed to read them metaphorically, allegorically, they're symbolic. The crown represents knowledge of God, and sitting represents not having work to do and not being bothered with all sorts of tasks that you have to handle like we do in this world. But they're reflective of of ideas, and they're not literally precise.
Kind of sounds like Shabbos.
Kind of sounds like Shabbos. A little bit, right? That we call Shabbos Me'ein Olam Haba, so I think understanding what you think of Olam Haba will affect how you think of how you experience Shabbos, for sure. So I think there's one underlying debate. Without reading the sources, right? So the Rambam and the Raivin, of course, two and three debate this. And
because they're not
Because his world is one where all souls are created.
Exactly, right? So how could it be all these literal physical descriptions, like the one in source number 4 in the Gemara and Brachot, you're going to sit with crowns on your head, and it doesn't make any sense. And so you have to say that those sources are allegorical sources. Right? So this relates to an idea that the Rambam has. It's a probably one of the more commonly read pieces of the Rambam, so it's good to take a look at it. We'll just touch on it very briefly, and now I'll see the handle just right after this. So the Rambam in source number 5, it's an introduction to... the Rambam has a commentary on the Mishnah. He wrote it, I think, starting when he was like 18 years old, very impressive. And within that commentary, he has a couple of longer essays that are sort of introductions to different sections, and those tend to be very interesting philosophically. So he has one where he introduces Pirkei Avot, and he discusses developing good character traits and different aspects of the human personality. And he has one at the beginning of what's called Perek Chilek, which is one of the chapters of the Mishnah, Masechet Sanhedrin. The Mishnah begins by saying, everyone has a Chilek in Olam Haba, that's why it's called Perek Chilek, except for people who believe this thing or that thing, if you're a heretic, if you don't believe that the Torah came from God, etc., etc. In his introduction, he deals with a lot of important philosophical issues, including how to read traditional texts, how to read Midrashim, how to read stories by our sages. And he identifies three approaches, only one of which he thinks is good. The first approach in the Rambam, and I outline that all for you in source number 5. The first approach says, when Chazal say something in a source, they mean it literally. And therefore, we should believe it. So when they say that the sages sit with crowns on their head in the world to come, that's what's going to happen. They're going to sit with crowns on their heads, and they'll be royalty, and it'll be very nice. The second approach takes Chazal literally and thinks that, therefore, Chazal are fools. How could you possibly believe that at the end of days we'll sit forever in eternal body with crowns on our heads and bask in the glow of the Shekhinah? Doesn't make any sense. It must be that these sages weren't so bright. So they both agree, these first two groups, that you read texts literally, and not metaphorically or allegorically. And you just disagree about whether you take it, you believe it or not. So either you believe it, and then you believe this strange literal thing, or you don't believe it, and you think that our tradition was foolish. The Rambam prefers his third group, which he says is, the first two groups he said are very big, lots of people fall into these groups, and the third group is very rare. As you can even barely call it a group, there aren't that many people who believe it. But we correctly believe that you're supposed to read these sources allegorically. Right? Chazal knew science and knew philosophy, so they wouldn't say anything that was obviously absurd. And you shouldn't assume that they said things that were obviously absurd. They just wrote in a code. They wrote in symbols and in metaphors and in language that you're meant to unpack. And the wiser you are and the more perceptive you are, the better you can unpack this language that Chazal used. So this is Rambam's view, and is very consistent with his perception of Olam Haba, which is all this physical language associated with Olam Haba, with Gan Eden. All of it is metaphorical. It represents ideas and not really the physical things as they're going to be. That is like one underlying debate between the heavenly approach and the supernatural earth approach. A second issue that might depend on this... Actually, I thought there was a question or a comment before. Sorry.
Going back to... And the argument between whether they'll have the crowns on their heads, the souls, whether it's just a place for souls or whether they might have crowns on their heads. Who's to say that our souls aren't just humanoid in nature, so they could have a head?
So I think what the Rambam would tell you...
Are you referring to the kippah?
I think what the Rambam would tell you is that if you understood philosophy correctly, you would never think such a thing. Of course a spiritual being cannot have a physical body.
Not
it cannot be physical anyway.
Not saying it's a physical body, saying it's more, it's a spiritual body, but it reflects your previous host.
So, does this body take up shape?
Well,
like, is there a shape to it? Does it take up space?
It's more malleable.
Okay, but does it exist in space? Like, can I point to it and say it's there and not there? Right? I think Rambam would say any description of a soul or of a spiritual being that you could say, look, it's over there, is like a false spiritual description. That's not what spiritual means. If that's true, then it's physical. It takes up space. It occupies, you know, the world in some way. That's why the Rambam is very, very adamant, as most of Jewish tradition is, that God cannot have a body. Right? This is like a... It's not even fair to really call it a debate. Like, the vast mainstream of Jewish thought says God doesn't have a body. Because God couldn't possibly have a body. That's philosophically not cogent that a being like God could have a body. The Rambam, in fact, says, and this is a good segue to point number two, in source number six, this is in Yisodei HaTorah, which is the section where he outlines real foundational philosophical ideas in his halachic code. Kol ha-mechubar me'arba yisodo elu, lahem hu nifrad basof. Rambam believes in this, like the avatar theory, right? The fire, earth, air, and water. Everything is made up of these four, you know, elements. Well, Rambam says anything that's made up of these four elements, which is a common Greek scientific idea, anything made of physical elements must also eventually decompose. It's impossible that there should be a physical thing that exists in the physical world that is made of physical stuff that will not eventually decompose. Which I think speaks exactly to the point of, if we're talking in the realm of the spiritual and the eternal, we cannot be talking about a thing that's in the physical world by definition. Now, if you're the Ravid or the Ramban or this whole other camp, the supernatural earth camp, you would disagree. You would say, yeah, in our world, everything decomposes. Physical things, you know, life dies and bodies decompose. But who's to say that God can't change the laws of nature and make physical things that don't decompose?
Well, don't, like, Malachim kind of have a form?
I think Rambam would tell you they do not. Rambam would say that angels, in the like spiritual celestial sense, they can't have a physical form if they're not in the physical world. And if they're in the physical world, then they're not eternal.
So then how did Hashem put like an image of what they would look like for the Aron?
Ah, okay. So this is a real puzzle, right? This is it's a parenthetical point, but it's an interesting one, which is the Rambam wants to believe two things at the same time. Halakhically, there's a prohibition to make images of angels. The Rambam believes that angels don't have images. They don't look like anything, because they're not physical. So according to the Rambam, how do you possibly violate that prohibition? It's not cogent. It's inconceivable. So there's literature on this. You probably have to say something like... You can say one of two things. Either you have sort of descriptions of how angels appear in visions, in the book of Yechezkel, for example. It begins with a sort of supernatural image that the prophet sees of God with his chariot and angels that surround him. So maybe don't make images like that.
I thought that was in Daniel.
In Daniel, you have the same thing, but funkier. The prophecies of Daniel are just there.
Daniel's weird.
Daniel's weird. Zachariah's a little weird. Some of these are very hard to... You know, the images are fun, but they're kind of psychedelic, shall we say. They're worth learning, though. They're really interesting, but they're hard. So... Or you could say, whatever people conventionally think is an angel, well, that's the thing you're not allowed to make. So I'm not allowed to draw those little cherubs with the wings, because that might be prohibited as well. But that's going to be a little bit further afield. Okay, so just to bring us back to our topic of Olam Haba. So one way to understand the debate about Olam Haba is to understand it's about how to read texts. Do you read them literally or do you read them allegorically? A second way to understand this debate is about understanding the laws of nature. The Rambam says everything physical decomposes, and that's an immutable law of nature that can never be changed. So therefore, by definition, we can't be physical in the world to come and eternal. Being physical and eternal is an internal contradiction. Whereas these other authorities would say, no, who's to say that you can't change the laws of nature in the future? God can do anything he wants. So he wants the physical world to have physical things that last forever? Totally fine. God can do whatever he wants. There's nothing inherently binding and immutable about the laws of nature. Right? God can make gravity stronger. God can make down up, and God can make eternal physical bodies. The third way to understand this debate, though, I think is really, really essential. Right? These are kind of technical ancillary details. The really essential one is to understand what it means, or what the most pristine human form is. Right? What is the essence of a human? What is the essence of a person? So, if you were to say, and this is summarized in a little paragraph in source number 8 by one of my teachers, Rabbi Yitzhak Bednar, she summarizes this perspective. But even without reading it, right, we can work out the details. According to Rambam, sort of heavenly spiritual model, so what does the Rambam think the essence of a human being is? The very core of what it means to be human? That lasts eternally? Just the neshama. Just your soul is the only thing that's really important. You have a physical body in the physical world, And maybe you need that physical body to train your soul, to help it improve and grow and whatnot. But that's not the essence of what you are. It's just a vessel that holds your soul in this world until you're able to break free from it and go to Olam Haba. According to these other opinions, the supernatural, physical world opinions, so what's the essence of a human being? It's something that combines a soul with a body. That's why the ultimate reward at the end of days is to be a soul in a body. In a perfected body, a body that's not subject to illness, that's not subject to hunger, but in a body nonetheless. And the fact that we're here in the physical world in physical bodies isn't a bug. It's not we have to be in bodies in order to accomplish X, Y, or Z thing. We're here in bodies because that's the way we're meant to be. That's the essence of what it means to be a human being. Which suggests a little bit that we shouldn't be so... You know, there are certain spiritual traditions that really try to, like, negate the body. Right? If you're a monk, so you're often subsisting on basic food. You're trying to enter these meditative states that take you out of the physical world, out of your physical body. And according to the Rambam, it makes perfect sense because it's all the spiritual, mental existence that's really the one that's important. And the fact that your physical is like a... Okay, so you have to eat in order to be able to accomplish that, but it's really very, you know, bidyeved. But according to other thinkers, they're going to say being in a physical body is exactly what we're meant to be. It's how we're meant to exist. And that's really the loftiest level we could possibly attain. So it could improve a little bit, but basically, we are the way that we're meant to be. And our bodies are a part of that. It's something to be celebrated, not necessarily to be shunned. So that, I think, is an important, I guess, way to break down this debate. Right, so just to summarize what we've seen two basic approaches to the discussion of Olam Haba. One in which the ultimate fate of each person is to be just a soul. And one in which we're meant to be souls in bodies, in perfected bodies. Either way, we're meant to enjoy the Shekhinah, enjoy Hashem's presence, and enjoy those spiritual rewards. But the question is, are the corporeal rewards, are the corporeal physical features of our existence things that are inherent and that we look forward to, that are part of our eternal life, or a temporary measure just to get our souls to the place where we want them to be? And fundamentally, I think, besides the interpretive debate and that philosophical debate about the laws of nature, there's a very essential debate about what it means to be a person. Are we souls that happen to be in bodies, or are we souls combined with bodies? And part of our identity is that we're both physical and spiritual. I think it relates a little bit to the second question, which is, okay, like, why does it matter? Right? I asked my wife last night how often she thinks about Olam Haba. She said not so often. I don't know. What, do you think about Olam Haba often? When's the last time you thought about it? Sometimes it gets to me like Yom Narayim time. Like at some point during Yom Kippur, I'm like trying to, you know, doing tshuva because it makes me a good person, doing tshuva because of, you know, my relationship with Hashem. And then like at some point, you're like, okay, just do tshuva because like you want Olam Haba and you don't want to like lose your portion of Olam Haba. Like sometimes those ideas come up. But it's not like a big central feature of our lives, I think. And that's really interesting because you could totally see it being a really important idea in religious life. I want to read one passage because it really gets this idea. This is from the beginning of the Sefer Mesilat Yesharim. It's by the Ramchal. It's a major, probably the most, I shouldn't say the most often studied. I haven't, you know, checked the data on this, but among the most often studied works of Musar in the world to ever have been written. And he describes the purpose of our existence. And the Ramchal says, Ha'adam lo nivra, the person was not created, elul hid'aneg al Hashem ulehanot biziv shechinato. It's just to enjoy God's presence and be connected to God. That is what life is all about. Now it happens to be, he goes on to say, in order to get there, and umakom ha'idun hazeh be'emet hu ha'olam haba. That's where you really get to enjoy God, in olam haba, not in this world, in the next world. He doesn't tell you what olam haba is in this passage, so I don't know whether he's a Rambamist or one of these other thinkers. But regardless, that's where you want to go. Ah, at the end of the line, haderach kadei lahagia al machoz chavsenu, zehu olam, zeha olam. How do you get to Olam Haba? You do well in this world. This world, in his, you know, consciousness, is basically a maze or an obstacle course. You go through it, You try to avoid tripping up as much as possible and doing as few errors as possible. You try to get as many mitzvah points as you can. I'm putting some words in his mouth. This is a very gross simplification of how we would think about things. But fundamentally, it's just a training ground. It's just the path that you take to get to Olam Haba. Right? There's a passage in the Mishnah in Avot that says this world is just the antechamber to the world to come. You have to go through the antechamber to get to where you want to go, but that's really where you want to be. And he describes this very, you know, extensively here. A little bit later, he backs down on some of these ideas as well. But for the Ramchal, for the Mezillah Yesharim, you could totally imagine a person going through the world constantly thinking, if I do this, will I get more Olam Haba? If I do this, is that going to be a better position for me in the future or worse?
Sounds like a selfish.
Okay, so later on in the book, the Mezillah Yesharim says, okay, that's really lo lishma. That's really serving God for the sake of reward, and you should really be more selfless and idealistic. And he would concede. But at least at the stage that this Mezillah Yesharim is addressing at the beginning of his book, it seems like a person totally focused on the other world. So one problem with that is that it's selfish. Right, you're focusing really on the reward. Selfish maybe isn't exactly the right word, but at least it's very lo lishma. You're somewhat insincere. You're really doing it for the reward of getting to be with God. Now, that's a very good motive. That might not be a selfish motive, but at least it's based on your reward. Are there other like objections or things that you might find like difficult to relate to in this perspective of the Mezillah Yesharim?
I can think of people in my life, maybe because I'm older, that really. You know, I think as you get older, okay, that's when you really think about that. I'm thinking of good people that are not like, I'm looking for the reward, but people who are like the kind of what you were saying, people who want to do mitzvot, people who are anchored that way, you know, thinking, not doing it because like, I want the Olam Haba reward, but kind of who think that's important in how you think about life.
So I think that's a very important distinction though,
yeah.
Right? If I do what I do because I'm trying to earn Olam Haba, which is the real existence, right? This is a temporary thing, right? I'm here for 120, let's say. Please God. Olam Haba, according to either opinion, is this eternal thing. You're either a soul in a spiritual world or in a physical world where you never are subject to decomposition and death. That's the world that really matters. Like, shouldn't you be focusing on that as much as you can? I think it's a perfectly cogent approach. Maybe not as ideal as we might want it to be, but you could imagine people living in that way. And there might even be people who do live that way. I shouldn't presume that there aren't. And that, I think, would dovetail a little bit with what you'd call, I think it fits that Rambam's perception of, like, fundamentally, we're souls. Fundamentally, we live outside of this world. We focus on the next world, the goals, the ideals. But it's not the only way to think about life. Other ways to paint that picture that don't focus on Olam Haba as much and are much more Olam Hazeh focused. I brought one picture, one perspective on this. This is from a sefer called the Shvi'i Eitz of the Israelite Sefer. He's a major, major posek of the 20th century. And he's describing the idea, I guess the ideology of Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, the way he thinks about the world, the way he thinks about life. And just, he has a whole description here. This whole page, page 6, is just a description of how he thinks about the world. But jumping to the top of the source, this is page 6. It's source number 10.
Nine.
The Israelite religion, the Jewish religion, does not wish to uproot the Jew from the soil of his growth and transplant him elsewhere. In other words, the goal of life is not, the goal of this world is not to take you out of this world. And to draw your attention and your focus to Olam Haba. That's not the goal. Rather, it wishes to influence the whole man, to prepare his whole heart, his thoughts and deeds for his exalted tasks. All that is human is near to it. For Judaism is, as Rav Hirsch himself put it, flawless, perfected harmony, a Jewish humanity. And he says this was true throughout Jewish history, from the period of Tanakh, to Chazal, to the early Rishonim, etc. Rav Hirsch presents a picture of a life that is not at all focused on the otherworldly, the reward, but on living human life well. That's what Judaism is about for Rav Hirsch. It keeps your focus totally on this world. I think if I met someone who said, I'm a Mesillas Yesharim Jew, and I just, everything I think about in terms of Olam Haba, in a very like visceral sense, I would say, like, you're not really living. Like, this world is just, again, it's just an obstacle course. You're just trying to, you know, dodge things as best you can until you're able to get to where you want to go. But Rav Hirsch would say, this world is a world you should live in, and live in it well. Judaism and humanity and living life well are totally compatible. It's true, as he describes later on, that during the, you know, including the Crusades and oppression, kind of squeezed that love of life out of the Jewish people. And we became a much more ritualistic, internal, insular, you know, less outwardly focused into the world and more just inwardly focused on ourselves kind of religion. And that happened for a long time. And then Rav Hirsch was living in a time, this sort of like renaissance of a Judaism that was engaged with the world, that tried to live life fully and well. I think we see a lot of that now when you think about Medina Israel. Think about Israel. That's a place where life is suffused with these aspects of meaning and purpose and religion. And it's not like you have your religious life and that's all you focus on, but the whole, all of human life, all of your country functioning is a manifestation of religious values. So I think just comparing these are two very like extreme approaches, and there's a whole range of middle positions and nuances. But I think part of how you think about Olam Haba is relevant to how you think about Olam Hazeh. Right? It could be that it's a terrible thing we don't think about Olam Haba more. It would be a great motivator to make sure that we're doing the right thing. It's the main existence. Right? We live here temporarily. We live there eternally. So we should totally be focused on Olam Haba. That would be the essential idea, but that would be a life that is very divorced from the concerns of this world. They matter only in as much as they affect your ability to do mitzvot and learn and avoid averas, but otherwise the world is not so relevant to you. The less you think about Olam Haba, and the more you focus your life on Olam Hazeh, not denying, of course, that Olam Haba exists and that it is the place of reward, but saying, that's reward. You get the reward at the end, but we don't serve God for the reward. That's lo lishma. God put us in this world to live a life in Olam Hazeh, and it's our job to live that life well. So Rav Hirsch says that involves an engagement with the world, being enlightened to the whole gamut of values and responsibilities of life. In modern state of Israel, that's brought to life even more and more palpably. And it's a completely different way of thinking about the world. Now, I'm not here to, you know, advocate. It's not obvious to me which of these perspectives will lead to a life that is best lived and then an Olam Haba that is best. Right? It could be that you're a Rav Hirsch Jew and you think about this world, but then you kind of think about this world as being meaningful in and of itself and maybe the most meaningful thing, and the Olam Haba gets short shrift. Maybe you start getting bogged down in all the details of this world. Not everything in this world is necessarily meaningful or valuable. Not for me to say which way of thinking about the world is different, but this question of Olam Haba becomes really essential for trying to figure out what kind of life you want to live. Do you want to live a life that's fundamentally of the soul, of the spirit, like the Rambam would want? It's fundamentally about learning and thinking and developing your character. It's a very inwardly focused life. Then you'll like the Rambam's view of Olam Haba, and you'll think more about Olam Haba, because that's really the essence of what life is. It's being a spiritual being. Or do you want to integrate your physical and spiritual selves, your corporeal and your incorporeal? Well, then you might like the Ramban. Well, that synergy is exactly what Olam Haba is about. It's about bridging the physical and the spiritual and being physical beings that are uplifted and enlightened. And you'll focus on the Rav Hirsch's perspective on the world, where the things that happen in the world are very much your concern. And living life in this world well is exactly the point. And the physicality is not to be shunned, but to be embraced. I think these two perspectives really, really, you know, lead to different lives, and it's interesting lives, and you don't have to pick one or the other. They're extremes. You have options when you think about your lives. Ooh, we usually finish before 9. I can't resist, you know, raising one more detail. It's important detail to raise without fleshing out the whole discussion. Right, so it's a whole issue, and I summarized a lot of the literature for you in pages 7 and 8. Olam Haba is, to say it most charitably, in the background of Tanakh, right? Now, this is going to be a big problem if you think Olam Haba is a big deal. If Olam Haba is a big deal, it's a real problem that Tanakh does not mention it. Right? In Shema, we say Shema every day, twice a day. So what's the reward for doing Hashem's mitzvah? second paragraph of Kriyat Shema. It's going to be rain. Your cattle will have grass to eat. You'll be able to live on your land safely. That's the reward. We don't think about Olam Haba reward. There are places where it's mentioned in Tanakh, more explicitly, less explicitly. Some of the references are summarized in source number 11 is one of the references, source number 13 quotes a few other examples where we assume this idea of an afterlife, but it's really in the background. And so we have to figure out why exactly that should be. Why should it be that if this is a really essential idea, it's Olam Haba, the ultimate eternal reward, why it shouldn't be mentioned in Tanakh? Really downplayed. So there are a lot of answers to this question. I think source number 14, Vednar summarizes, I think, 10 different answers to this question. But I think it could relate to the issues we've been raising, which is how central should Olam Haba be in your life? It could be that Tanakh doesn't mention Olam Haba because it's trying to say Olam Haba is not the biggest deal. It's going to happen. It's true. By virtue of being beings with souls, our souls are going to be eternal. But that's not the main thing. The main thing Tanakh's getting across is living Olam Hazeh well. Knowing there's Olam Haba and letting that inspire Olam Hazeh, but not replace it. Not thinking and trying to transcend this world to go into the next, but I'm in this world, I'm going to do it as best I can. And Olam Haba will be great, I'm so excited for it. Just after, not looking to, you know, looking to have a long, happy Olam Hazeh first, but Olam Haba, when it comes, at the right time, it'll be great. Od Chazon LaMoed, we'll leave a few of the details for some later discussion. But just to recap what we've seen, so we started with the basic foundational debate about the nature of Olam Haba. Is it an eternal spiritual world completely divorced from the physical, or is it an eternal world of physical bridged with spiritual that includes some improved physical bodies? We offered three ways of understanding that debate. Is it a debate about how to read traditional sources, literally or allegorically? Is it a debate about whether the laws of nature are immutable or not? Could it be that physical things could ever exist that are eternal? Or is it a debate about what is the essence of what it means to be a person? A soul that happens to be in a body, or a soul that is integrated with the body? And we saw that that might lead to two very different outlooks on life. The more you think of yourself as a soul that happens to be in a body, the more you're going to focus on the next world and internal pursuits and edifying your soul. The more you think of yourself as a soul integrated with the body, integrated with the physical world, so the more your focus in life will be on that bridge and on the physical world while you're here and on the spiritual world when you get there. And then we suggested perhaps that might have to do with the lack of emphasis in the period of Tanakh on this theme. So there are other ways to explain it, but one possible way to explain it that the Tanakh might not mention Olam Haba because you're not meant to be thinking about it so much. It's true, it's an important idea, but it's not meant to be the core of our religious lives. It's meant to be in the background. And I think it's very convenient, very nice, that for many of us it really is. We don't think about doing the right thing because of Olam Haba so much, but we think about Olam Haba as a great reward, but our lives right now are being inherently meaningful. And the mitzvot and the opportunities we have here in Olam Hazeh being essential as well. Okay. Add kind of the summary.